This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, U.S. President Barack Obama is on the verge of clinching one of the largest free trade accords in over 20 years and one central to his presidential legacy. The Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Deal, also known as TPP, is an ambitious effort negotiated among the United States and 11 countries around the Pacific Rim, which will lower trade barriers to goods and services and set commercial rules of the road for approximately 40% of the world's economy. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. Along with the United States and Japan, the other partnership members are Australia, Brunei, Canada, Chile, Malaysia, Mexico, New Zealand, Peru, Singapore, and Vietnam. China, the world's second largest economy, decided not to join the trade pact as it pursues its own economic agenda. The TPP has been in the works since about 2008, but had been stymied until now by disputes over sensitive industries, including automobiles and agriculture. President Obama says the agreement would render the United States more competitive by eliminating about 18,000 taxes and tariffs that are placed on American products and would open up new markets for goods made in America. Before it can be implemented, though, the deal must be approved by Congress. Lawmakers would have about 30 days to review the deal before it is made public. While Democratic President Obama should be able to win support from Republicans, who traditionally favor trade deals, he may have more trouble from his Democratic caucus, who are less inclined to support it. Complicating passage is the fact that it will be debated during a presidential election campaign. Democratic frontrunner Hillary Clinton has already come out against it, contradicting her position in favor of the deal when she was Secretary of State and championed the so-called pivot to Asia. Parliaments and legislatures of all 12 countries must ratify the deal as well. Well, with us to discuss the pros and cons of the TPP and challenges ahead for ratification are two distinguished analysts. Brian Riley is senior analyst in trade policy at the Heritage Foundation. That's a Washington-based think tank. And Jim Kessler, he's senior vice president for policy at Third Way. That's a centrist think tank also based in Washington. And both panelists join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in the nation's capital. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Brian, let me begin with you. We know that the full text of the TPP has not yet been released, but what we know of the broad outlines, are you for or against this deal and why?
We're taking a wait-and-see approach at this stage. We have several things we think will be good that we would like to see in the agreement, and we're very happy the text is going to be made public. Part of the deal is this is going to be published on the internet for at least 60 days for everybody in the country and everybody in the world to read. I'm a little concerned. I get the politics, but when I see interest groups on either side or politicians immediately jumping in and saying this is going to be the best trade deal in history or this is going to devastate the United States, it's too soon to make those kinds of a judgment, at least from the Heritage Foundation's perspective. One thing I think that is important for us at Heritage is this is the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It's not the Trans-Pacific Free Trade Agreement. We love free trade at the Heritage Foundation, want to get rid of trade barriers and have more economic freedom, but there's going to be a lot more besides the traditional trade aspects of this agreement, which could be good on things like state-owned enterprises or intellectual property. And when I say state-owned enterprises, I mean the use of government agencies to really play a big role in the economy, something that countries like China certainly currently rely on. So it's hopefully going to be a good free trade agreement and is going to have a lot of other good areas that will strengthen the U.S. economy as well. But until I see the agreement, I'm not willing to go that far just yet, Carol.
Turning to you, Jim Kessler, again, with the caveat that we haven't seen the full text, but on the broad outlines, from what we know, how do you see this deal as benefiting America and its partners, or are its drawbacks perhaps overshadowing the good parts? How do you see it?
I will go out on a limb. I haven't seen the text, obviously, but there's enough that we already know about. Our organization, Third Way, we believe this is one of the most important deals for the middle class in the U.S. that's come around in a long time. We think it's absolutely essential for the growth of our economy and to create new jobs. And when the deal was reached and all the trade ministers gathered for the press conference, I believe it was the Australian trade minister who said, long after people debate about how many million tons of butter can be exported from one country to another, what this deal really does, it sets the trade rules and the rules for commerce in 40% of the world, and it's key, it's in Asia, and the truth of the matter is either the United States and like-minded countries are going to set those rules, or China is going to set those rules. And there is no chance on earth that if China sets the rules, that's good for this country.
Back to you, Ryan Riley. Jim Kessler makes a good point about China. It's not in the pact. And the fact that this pact is not only potentially beneficial on the economic side, but also geopolitical. As Jim Kessler said, it gives the opportunity to the United States and its partners to write the trade rules. How do you see that aspect of the partnership should it come to pass?
I'd hate to see us in the United States approve a bad agreement for good geopolitical reasons. I think we absolutely have to think about what this means for the future. And if it's a bad agreement or a good agreement that doesn't get approved, clearly there's a risk that that's a big opening for China to play a larger role in the area. So I absolutely agree with Jim to the extent that if it's a good agreement and we don't approve it, that's going to be bad, not just economically, but geopolitically. One of the pluses of this agreement is just even by announcing that we have an agreement done, it's caused China and Europe and others to take a more active role and say, hey, we need to expand our own trade agreements. And it's a kind of competition that I think is positive, where countries are working to expand trade as opposed to throwing up trade blocks. I certainly hope it's a good agreement and one that will help set good rules. One area that we think is really important is something that's written into the U.S. Constitution, that the government can't steal your property without compensating you. That is included in many of our agreements and hopefully will be included with strong enforcement mechanisms in this agreement. So if a foreign government were to steal the property of an American investor or vice versa, there would be ways to prevent that from happening in the future.
Back to you, Jim Kessler. Brian Riley brought up that it could be a good agreement or a bad agreement. He'd rather not approve a bad agreement because we don't know the full text. But this also brings up the question of the fact that Trade Promotion Authority was passed before this agreement was announced. And of course, that is a prerequisite, is it not, for the deal. It doesn't permit the Congress to make any amendments to it. It has to be an up or down vote. So that could be tricky.
So procedurally, in the United States, and we're the only country that has to do this, we pass sort of a pre-agreement that essentially allows the president to come to an agreement, and then Congress is not allowed to amend that trade agreement. And the reason why we have to do that is because no country wants to sign off on a deal, and then the U.S. Congress says, by the way, we're going to change that tobacco provision and this thing for pork bellies. So they need to have something that when the deal is signed, it's going to be up or down vote. Other countries don't have to go through this because they're either a parliamentary system or some other form of authoritarian system, and they don't really have to worry about their Congress or their parliament changing things. But that's what we have to do in this country. That vote was very close here in our Congress. Republicans supplied most of the votes, but the margins were pretty thin.
We will get into the politics of the deal in just a moment, but first a short break. We'll be right back.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOAnews.com.
Visit our website at VOAnews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
Welcome back to Encounter. We're talking about the significance and politics of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Deal, also known as TPP. Well, back to you, Brian Riley, to talk about the politics, which is very odd. We have a Democratic president, very pro-trade, at odds with his own Democratic Party, but in sync with the Republicans, but with a Republican Congress who doesn't like to give President Obama many victories. So let's get to the politics and talk about those challenges. Even Hillary Clinton, as I said in the introduction, the Democratic front runner so far, was for it while she was Secretary of State, now against it. It appears that that's more of a political decision, although she says that she hasn't seen the full text and therefore wants to reserve judgment. But what are some of the arguments that you've heard of those who are opposed to it on the merits?
some of the arguments are ones that I find not very convincing. The arguments that this is going to lead to a lot of outsourcing, that it's going to be bad for manufacturing. You hear the phrase of things like NAFTA on steroids, and people will throw out studies saying, well, this trade agreement costs hundreds of thousands of jobs. You go back and look at the numbers, as we've done at Heritage, and I think Third Way and other groups have as well. Our previous trade agreements haven't been perfect, but U.S. economies added millions of jobs since NAFTA was passed. Our manufacturing output has improved significantly since China joined the World Trade Organization. And these facts, critics just seem to ignore. Fact of the matter is that as countries remove trade barriers and promote good economic policies, they're going to prosper, whether they do it on their own or whether they do it as part of a trade agreement. The Heritage Foundation is a conservative think tank, but I was reading a poll which said Democrat voters tend to be more supportive of free trade than Republican voters. But clearly, you look at the environmental groups and labor unions, they tend to be opposed to these deals. And the business groups that tend to support Republicans tend to be supportive of these deals. You mentioned Hillary Clinton, then you've got somebody like Donald Trump, who immediately said, I would negotiate a fantastic deal, or whatever his words were. So throw it out and start from scratch. I'm curious to see how the Republican candidates come down, because historically, really the golden age for trade in recent years was when you had administrations like the Reagan administration and the Clinton administration pursuing policies that they thought were good for the country and not just based on politics.
Turning to you, Jim Kessler, to talk about the politics, the strange bedfellows here. Why do you think Democrats, even Hillary Clinton, who came out for this deal initially when she was Secretary of State, are running away from this trade deal? Do they have objections on the merits, or is it politics, especially in a presidential election year? What's at play?
There's a few things. So first of all, there's kind of a rule in presidential politics that virtually nobody ever supports a trade deal when they're running for president, and no one opposes a trade deal when they are president. So there's a little bit of a dichotomy that's going on there. Number two is nobody has ever lost an election in this country because they opposed a trade deal. So even if trade deals sometimes poll fairly well, the salience, the passion, is generally on the side of folks that oppose it. That's number two. Number three is the Democratic interest groups, mostly organized labor, but also some of the other groups. They provide a lot of money, a lot of organizational support for Democrats. They're very key to Democrats getting elected and reelected. They oppose this deal. So the question for a lot of Democrats is, do I do what I think may or may not be right, or go out on a limb, or do I make the safe choice and make kind of all my constituency groups happy? So on the Democratic side, if you're supporting a trade deal, it is a vote of courage, because your entire constituency is not really on your side.
And I would suggest, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, not to be too cynical, but votes of courage are pretty few and far between.
Indeed. We're going to talk about the substance of the trade deal in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Encounter on The Voice of America. My guests are Brian Riley, senior analyst in trade policy at the Heritage Foundation. That's a Washington-based think tank. And Jim Kessler, he's senior vice president for policy at Third Way. That's a centrist think tank also based here in Washington. We're talking about the significance and the politics of the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal and what it will mean moving forward. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA, or connect with us on Facebook. You may also send an email to encounter@voanews.com. Here's a shout-out to our loyal listener, Diane Schwartzman Samuels, from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. If you want to hear your name on the show, please send us an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us on Facebook. Well, back to you, Brian Riley, to talk about the substance, because what I've heard, again, not having the benefit of seeing the text, is that the environmental standards and working conditions that were worked out among the participating 11 countries are quite solid, and that they could actually appeal to those in the labor movement who traditionally might be skeptical of trade deals. So let's take a look at the merits. And will this trade deal, as some labor unions are saying, Will this cost jobs or expand jobs?
Well, I think good trade agreements, to be honest, they always cost jobs, but they also create jobs. And that's what, when you have a growing economy, you have creative destruction. I mean, you're always churning, creating jobs. The important thing to look at is this going to lead to more good jobs? And good trade agreements certainly do that. I'm not sure the idea that the administration says this is an agreement that's going to have great environmental and labor provisions, I think that risks alienating some conservative support that might like the idea of more free trade and good trade rules, but might not like the idea of a big multinational government agency authorizing governments to use trade barriers to enforce environmental or labor policies, just hypothetically. But at the same time, it doesn't seem like they've managed to get support from environmental groups or from labor groups for going this direction. So that might be a loser politically. Some groups, no matter what you do, they're never going to be happy with respect to trade agreements. And I think that's just the reality.
Turning to you, Jim Kessler, to paraphrase Brian Riley, it does seem that one is damned if you do or damned if you don't, as we say here in America. But it does seem that the partners in this trade pact went out of their way to negotiate high labor and environmental standards that could placate some of the people in the environmental lobby and the labor unions who would normally come out against the trade deal. How do you see these standards, and do you think they could mollify those groups?
I don't think they'll mollify the groups, but I think the standards are important, and they help make the agreement a very good agreement that will create jobs and increase wealth in the United States and in these other countries. One of the things we learned from NAFTA, so we passed NAFTA in 1994. It did not have labor and environmental standards there. It's pretty fair to say that NAFTA did not deliver the goods for the United States as promised. I wouldn't go as far as say that it was a net loser, but it certainly wasn't a big winner.
And NAFTA, of course, that's the trade agreement between the United
Mexico and Canada and the United States, the North American Free Trade Agreement. The United States has concluded 17 trade agreements since NAFTA, and they've changed. They added labor and environmental standards, in part because maybe the right thing to do for humanity reasons, but also because it lessened some of the differences between the countries and how they produced goods. And if you look at those 17 countries where we had trade deals since NAFTA, when we've added labor and environmental standards, our trade balance with those countries in the blue-collar goods sector got better by about $30 billion on an average annual basis. This TPP deal is the strongest yet on labor, environmental standards, human rights standards. It is the gold standard for trade deals. It should help the U.S. economy. It should create jobs. It should create wealth. And it is a model for future agreements.
Back to you, Brian Riley. As you said, though, the politics of it could scuttle the deal, and that's of great concern, particularly from the Republican side, who normally would favor the deal, but maybe, as you said, because they don't want to hand President Obama a victory, which would be unfortunate.
Well, it's not just that. I like to hope, anyway, that it's not just politics. We don't want to give President Obama a victory, although for some members that certainly could be the case. When an agreement is announced, and certainly it's been the case with this agreement, those who are going to be opposed to it immediately jumped on it and attacked it and forced some of the presidential candidates to take positions right away, arguably prematurely, where groups that might be more inclined to support it tended to be more lukewarm. Either they've said, like the Heritage Foundation, we're going to wait till we see the text, or the enthusiasm level from potential supporters has not matched the enthusiasm for opponents at this stage. And they're already talking about delaying it till after the elections. But for this to have an opportunity to pass, you're going to have enthusiasm, whether that's led by the presidential administration or from those who stand to gain and create jobs economically. Otherwise, it risks not passing. And Jim, correct me if I'm wrong, that prior trade deals have been controversial and they've been tough, but they've all passed at the end of the day. And I'm not sure that's going to be the case here.
Jim Kessler, I'd like to get your view on Hillary Clinton's position. You used to work for a Democratic senator, Charles Schumer. Why do you think she did this? Do you think she's sincere that she wants to look at the merits, or is she playing some politics here to try to get some of the Bernie Sanders, the candidate to her left, his constituents?
Well, I take her at her word that she says that she has substantive problems with the agreements. I am sure that her opponents, both on the left and on the right, are going to make a big deal of the fact that when she was in the administration, she seemed very supportive of it. So that's the calculation that's going to be going on in the American political system. No one has ever lost an election because they opposed a trade deal. The salience is almost all on the opposing side. It's the right thing to do, but generally doesn't generate enthusiasm. It's rare to see like a boisterous pro-trade million-person rally in America. Look, this is something that Congress is going to have to deal with and pass and do something that Congress has been unable to do in the last 6 years, and that is take 90% of a loaf and not 100% of a loaf. And realize that there's going to be something in there that you don't like. But on the whole, the deal is good and it's super important for this country. It's either us or China is going to be setting these rules. China has an agreement. They're ready to go. It's called RCEP. Our agreement is hundreds and hundreds of pages long. Theirs is 8 pages long because they don't have any standards. It's just basically using state-owned enterprises and their own version of manipulation and currency shenanigans so that they are essentially setting the rules for Asia. It's got to be us. It can't be them.
Back to you, Brian Riley. Politics aside, merits aside, to me at least, the fact that this agreement could be a counterweight to China, that would trump even those arguments. When we look at how China is behaving in the South China Sea, aggressively against many of the United States allies, and again, not abiding by rules, what about that argument?
One of the hopes is that this is a good agreement, and it's something that encourages China to adopt policies that are in their own interest with respect to reining in state-owned enterprises and subsidies and some of the things they do to distort their own economy. So that'd certainly be the hope. From the trade angle, trade agreements have typically been sold as this is going to tear down foreign barriers and give us more export opportunities. And TPP, hopefully, I expect, will do that. We'll have more access to Japan, one of the country's biggest economies, than we do right now. When I say we, I mean agricultural producers, for example. But the benefit of a trade agreement, too, should be the United States, we get rid of our self-destructive barriers.
What happens, Brian Riley, if the United States doesn't ratify the agreement? And then there are 10 other countries also, perhaps have fewer obstacles. But does it just go away? Do we take a look at it another day?
The longer we delay, then the more chance there is for somebody else to fill the void, whether it's China or whether it's just us being left by the wayside while other countries move forward. Also, I think politically, the longer we delay, it's possible that on the Republican side, they may say, well, we might have a Republican administration in a few months. Maybe we just want to wait and redo it. And that could be good if it results in a better agreement. But Jim is exactly right that there's a danger of delay, and that creates more uncertainty. And our trading partners who have negotiated hard with us for years, if they perceive the U.S. now says, well, we're not going to do it, that will have repercussions that need to be considered.
Turning to you, Jim Kessler, for your take on the obstacles going forward, the challenges here in the United States, the politics, as well as how it affects the other partner countries, and to what extent this deal may eventually be scuttled, and what are the consequences?
I think the obstacles are this. If you look at the U.S. Congress, if this was a secret ballot, this would pass by a wide margin.
Even with Democratic votes?
I think probably close to half of Democrats would support it. It's not. That's not the system we have, which is good. But the interest groups that are opposing this, particularly in the Democratic side, are really the most powerful interest groups in the Democratic pantheon. So you've got a president who's very progressive, who's promoting it. That helps. And there are a group of Democrats, 28 in the House and 13 in the Senate, that voted for it that I think are pretty solid. But this is going to be touch and go all the way through. And my guess is it passes. I would be stunned if it doesn't, but in a way stunned but not surprised. I mean, this is still more or less a 50-50 proposition. There is no going back. If this deal goes down, it goes down hard and it goes down for good. The vacuum will be filled. It'll be filled almost certainly by China. They're raring to go. These other countries are ready to sign with China if the U.S. won't be their dance partner.
On that note, that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Brian Riley, he's Senior Analyst in Trade Policy at the Heritage Foundation, and Jim Kessler, Senior Vice President for Policy at Third Way. Thank you both for your terrific insights.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Linus Rimkus. I'm Carol Castile. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.